relatively full stomach. And it's nice to see that people have already started talking, and we're hoping that this lunch seminar series is really dialogical and also relatively relaxed. So it gives me great pleasure to introduce our speaker today, Professor Yue Zhizhao. Up till I think last year this time, she was a professor at Simon Fraser University and was also the Canada Research Chair, which is a very prestigious position. And right now, or ever since last year, I think around springtime, Professor Zhao told me that she decided to take early retirement from Simon Fraser and move back to Tsinghua University in China. So her official affiliation now is really with Tsinghua University in Beijing. And the topic she's gonna discuss today is, I think, something that she's been working on maybe in the past 10 years. I think you founded the Heyang Research Institute. Is it the Research Institute for Rural Development?
Yes.
In 2015.
Yeah.
And I believe that's also a very important reason that she decided to leave Vancouver and move back to Beijing. So you will hear more about her research. And I just want to say that on a personal note, the first time I met Professor Zhao is when I was a PhD student in the US. We met at a very small marginalized conference for radical leftist scholars. And since then, Professor Zhao has really been an inspiration for me. On so many levels, I think politically, intellectually, and she is, you know, in a way my role model and make me think that, okay, the kind of research I want to do, it's still possible to do that, although albeit it's becoming increasingly difficult to do this kind of research, to voice this kind of opinion within the current context of escalating geopolitical tension. And also, Professor Zhao was my external referee for both my tenure review and my promotion. So it gives me really a great pleasure to have her here today. I'm so glad that she decided to make a stop at LSE on her way to her daughter Linda's graduation at Oxford. So please join me to welcome Professor Zhao.
Thank you, Bingchen, for the lovely introduction. And on that last note, you realize now, right? The reason I positively support her to be here is so that I can come here. Don't tell the authorities, okay? It's really a great honor to be here. And indeed, it was last May Day, May 1st, last year, I officially retired early from Simon Fraser University, and I got my title, Professor Emeritus. So you can know how old I am, right? You got to be a full professor for 10 years before you can be recognized as a Professor Emeritus, which is our official status. So I'm officially a Professor Emeritus at Simon Fraser University and Humanities Chair Professor at Tsinghua University, which is, yes, pretty not as good as the Canada Research Chair, but still big deal in Tsinghua, at Tsinghua. They only have 3 people of my type. So it's a great honor, but what I'm going to talk today really is my other incarnation, which Bingchen just introduced. 10 years ago, I decided to, even while I was still at Simon Fraser University, decided to do something about rural decline, turn myself into not an anthropologist, you know, going to a village, doing research as a more or less observer, you know, if not totally objective, but try as much as can you can in the traditional anthropological way. I went back to my village, became an activist, rural agrarian activist. And then most of my research can be characterized as participatory action research. So if I sound like a saleswoman for my hometown, that it is, that's me. In the middle, I will show you some rural products, but I want to make sure they're not yet commodified. So it should be okay. And I'm going to leave this to Bingchen as my gift. So, okay. I know this is a serious place. It's a very, you know, I've checked some of the talks for the last week. I also checked the title of the talk in this series last time. My talk is very, I would say, very small in terms of the, well, niche in terms of the topic. But if you think about, you know, how big rural China is still in terms of population, even by residential status, more than 500 million Chinese, or probably even a little bit more, are still rural population. That's quite a big deal. So I'm going to, again, and also nowadays, you know, there's a lot of grand narrative about China's rising, China's this and that. So of course, none of us can be free or not engaged with that kind of narratives. But I'm trying today to focus on some underground discoveries. At the same time, of course, I will engage with grand narratives. So my point of entry is communication culture. That's my field. But a big topic is rural revitalization, okay? And I'm drawing on stories from my hometown. Jinyi is a county in China, which is a basic administrative unit, right? In Zhejiang province. Sorry, I didn't have a picture for you, but nowadays, you know, LSE, I'm sure you can bring up your own mental picture of China, Zhejiang province on the east coast, and Jinyi in the middle of Zhejiang province, okay? I have an introduction in which I will show you a grand narrative, proceeding the rural from Marx to Xi, okay? A few weeks ago, I happened to be at the CPC's Central Party School. So these pictures are from the Central Party School. I took it myself. As I go on, you will recognize why or realize why I'm using these photos, okay? So this is a statue, of course, two people, okay, Marx and Engels, right? At the Central Party School. And the quotation, some of you might be familiar with, is from the Communist Manifesto, a famous passage, basically. It says how the bourgeoisie subject the country to the rule of the cons, right? And it creates enormous cities like London, has greatly increased the urban population as compared with the rural, right? And it has thus rescued a considerable part of the population from the idiocy of rural life. This is a questionable phrase, actually. I'm not going to go into great detail. If you read that and think of people like me, I must be one of those who are rescued from the idiocy of the countryside, right? Idiocy being translated in Chinese as ignorant. This is the English translation, idiocy, right? Which again, you're idiot, right? So when in China, when you want to talk down to people, when you want to accuse somebody of ignorant, you know me, you're peasant, right? It's a face of accusation. But some expert of the Communist Manifesto argue that in original German language, this is not like the current English translation of idiot. It means isolation, idiom-like, or fixed, okay? Fixed or isolation doesn't mean you are stupid. It's just
just that you're not connected to the high-speed railway, you're not connected to 5G yet. But it doesn't mean the traditional peasantry were stupid or ignorant or stubborn or reactionary. Of course, they have that sign. Anyway, this is something I want to come back later, but just keep that in mind, okay? So just as it has made the country dependent on the tongs, so it has made barbarian and Simon barbarian countries dependent on the civilized ones. Nations of peasants on nations of bourgeoisie, the East on the West. So if you read this paragraph, that's the whole world process, right? China had been subject to this process. There's no question about it. Then the question is this reversible? Or when in the end, China was indeed being integrated into the global system, into this process, what's next? Is that what's going on today, right? So that's why I want to start from here. This process has been ongoing. China was part of this process without choice, basically, since the Opium War, right? And people like me, myself, were indeed got integrated from, moved from the countryside to the cities, right? Whole generation over the reform period, China's urban population grew from about 20% of the entire population to now about 50-50. So that's a huge movement, right? So the process is still ongoing, but is this going to be just a one-way ticket or what, right? So that's the question. Now, in the 20th century, as Mao engaged in, well, early on, communist revolution in the urban area, but when that didn't work, Mao ended up turning to the countryside, right? After that, or during the earlier 30s, 40s, and way into the earlier 50s, until 53, after the PRC was established, Mao had an ongoing debate with Liang Shuming, okay, about China's future. And they were both born in the same year, okay, 1918. The difference, of course, is Liang Shuming argued for reform, gradual process. Liang Shuming himself was doing what I'm doing these days, rural construction or reconstruction. Mao realized you need revolution. In order to solve China's agrarian problem, reform it was not the way, according to Mao. All the struggle was the way. Liang Shuming didn't like that. And Mao's, of course, conceptual tool came from the Communist Manifesto, right? So class was the key concept for Mao, but Liang didn't like the concept of class. He said in Chinese traditional society, there was no such a thing as class. Instead, people are divided by occupation, by bound by ethical community values. So there was a tremendous debate. That, of course, Mao, you can say, won the debate with the founding of the People's Republic of China. And then immediately after 49, Mao started the general transitional program to socialism, right? And during that process, Mao elevated industrialization as a priority. And in this process, you didn't have the luxury or the condition for colonization, right? Like what UK did. So what you did in China is you extract your surplus value from the peasants. So the Chinese peasantry were subject to a ruthless process of industrialization. So much so that after the Great Leap Forward, a lot of people died of famine. I'm speaking as my own grandfather, my mother's father, died in 61, before I was 63, before I was born. So I was born without a grandfather because of the famine, okay? So Liang Shuming, of course that was later, but early on, as early as 53, Liang Shuming had already criticized Mao for elevating the role of workers industrialization over peasants and accusing Mao of betraying the peasants, because Mao depend on peasants for the revolution, right? But Mao said, well, you might have a general, you know, gentle heart towards the peasants, but in a world system like this, you had no choice but to secure your primitive accumulation through the exploitation of peasants. Because you need to industrialize. You need to catch up on the industrial side. Yes, and you need to create a bomb in order to secure your national independence. So there was a huge debate. Of course, by that time, Mao had already been in power, while Liang Shumin was just a leader of the Democratic parties, right? So he was subject to, you know, criticism, all that. Anyway, that was an important debate for China. And I want to jump forward. Why? This is another picture. I like it. From, again, took from the Central Party School, where you have a young Mao marching for ahead and with the slogan, going our own way, okay? So Mao went his own way. Now, you want to take this off, right? Yes. Okay, now jump to the Xi era. Xi and the new era, one of the key slogans that resonates with me is there will be no national rejuvenation without rural revitalization, right? As most of you know, once China entered the Deng era, class discourse was pushed to the background. National discourse was forwarded. And nowadays, you know, national rejuvenation, 中华民族的伟大复兴, have become the rally point, right? And then within that discourse, you have the slogan of no rural revitalization, no national rejuvenation. 民族要振兴乡村必, 民族要复兴乡村必振兴, right? So over the past two party congresses from the 90s, in 2017, at that party congress, the CCP put rural revitalization as a national strategy. And it has a three-step process, which I'm not going to go detail. So, you know, a graduation of the realization of the objective of a strong rural economy, beautiful countryside, and the prosperous farmers, okay? That's the 19th Party Congress. And then move on to the 20th Congress. It no longer foregrounds that rural revitalization strategy because it was already in the Central Party policy, right? The key point is the definition of China's modernization, right? 中国式现代化. And so of the five dimensions there, I would say, you know, the rural is the unspoken elephant, really. A huge population, right? Yes, even now, as I said, you know, there are still one third or even more percentage of that population who are still rural. So the modernization of huge population, common prosperity, you will recognize that. Most of the poor people are still in the rural areas, right? Material and cultural ethical advancement, which again points strongly to the rural because traditional Chinese culture stress the cultivation of both the land and the mind, right? And then harmony of humanity and the nature. Well, the rural area is being seen as more representative of that. And then peaceful development. Why this is related to the rural? Because the argument has been made by scholars from Yang Hailong, Li Xinyu, or many others, that the reason for China historically didn't turn itself into an imperialist nation in a sense of, you know, great exploration like, you know, the Western colonial powers was because traditional China emphasized urban-rural reciprocal relationship. China historically had huge big cities like Chang'an, Luoyang, Taifeng. They were all, you know, at that time, equivalent to London, probably, or New York. But those cities were not expanding in a way like Western colonial cities. They end up, the entire regime or, you know, the dynasties focus on a reciprocal relationship between the urban and rural. For example, officials like me, if I retired, I'm supposed to go back to the countryside. So overall, historical China, imperial China, didn't follow a path of development that is described by the Communist Manifesto, like the passage I described to you earlier. And they say that path is related to a more reciprocal urban-rural relationship. And that is a path that's more peaceful, i.e. China didn't go out to colonize like the West. Okay, so that's a convoluted argument. But anyway, what I want to emphasize is that by the 20th Party Congress, when China's modernization or the Chinese path of modernization was defined, you can still see of these five dimensions, the rural is still the unspoken elephant, okay? And so, of course, the party can also be revisionist in our way. For example, this scene on this, people, if you can read the Chinese, you can see this. The claim is that in China, official policy had never, even from the beginning, promote urbanization. Even though actual policy, actual development is. That's why you have huge Beishang Wang, right? Big cities. But now they say, well, in the beginning, we never promote urbanization. We promote Chen Zheng Hua, i.e., the integration of urban rural development, or we want to develop on smaller cities. Well, in reality, I think this became a clear policy on 2013 when Xi Jinping indeed called a conference of Chen Zhenghua rather than urbanization. Again, I feel this is a little bit revisionist, but still official policy claimed that China never promoted urbanization. It has always been Chen Zhenghua. I don't know the Chinese translation for Chen Zhenghua because in the West, you don't have this term. And when I check English translation for this, it's all urbanization. So already you can see the incompatible nature of these two discourses. Believe me, I checked. I said, okay, how I check. Maybe what I checked was not good enough, but I don't have an English term for Chen Zhenghua. If you have one, tell me, okay? Again, so return to my own focus, communication culture. So in this whole process of trying to carve out a Chinese model of development that goes against the tide of what I described or what I cite from the Communist Manifesto, the Chinese government nowadays focus on communication, digitization. This is a screenshot of CCTV. As I was preparing this, I turned on CCTV news. Well, it's running there as a bad one. Hey, this I can use. The state plan for digitization in rural areas for 2023, okay? Huge, long news about everything. Nowadays, if you do go to the Chinese countryside, you will see all kinds of efforts to promote digitization. Believe me, one day when I was in northern Zhejiang province, which is more advanced, I found myself chasing the garbage black truck. Why? Because each in a village, each garbage can has a barcode. So each family, household, each morning, how much wet garbage, like chicken leftovers you put out, how much dry you're supposed to sort out, right? It will be weighted the moment the garbage man drives this truck and put the garbage can on a scale, basically. It has and then it will scan the barcode. So families will get awarded if you send out more, you know, chicken waste, kitchen waste, for example, to the station. The figures, the moment the garbage cans was put on the track, figures that all has already been transferred to the central collecting place. I was really impressed. And I was thinking, wow, for those communication study people, why don't you do this as a, you know, digital whatever research, right? So again, I have pictures, but I feel too much. Okay, so digitization in the countryside can be as advanced as that, okay? And then culture, festivity, right? This is a picture from my hometown again. Like I said, I'm going to go all the way. Over the last weekend, it's Zibo, right? For those of you who know, mainland China. It's crazy, right? People go there for barbecue, pork or whatever. So on the digitization side, the state is really pushing digitization on the countryside, and then cultural revitalization, I will show you later, everything, right? It has been a tremendous process of revival of culture. See, these are the lanterns on that festival, and that on each, it's a local specialty food, right? 沙蟹小吃, all that. So here's my, for you to take home. Weber Schramm at the Central Party School. For those who study communications, you heard of Weber Schramm, right? He was seen as one of the founding fathers of the discipline. And last year was the 40th anniversary of his visit inside mainland China, which initiated the communication discipline. And how he got to China, or what event he attended in Guangzhou, a conference promoting 夜话教育, i.e. use television for universalized or more popular education. So today, online learning, you see. Early on was televised learning, right? So he, Weber Schramm, as a cold warrior, really an anti-communist, and that first time visiting China in 82, attending a conference promoting televised or television assisted education. And then guess what? Just last week, the CCP, Central Party School, and the Central Propaganda, no, Organizational Department, organized a nationwide class of all the Chinese village party secretaries. They were not allowed to take their cell phones. They were asked, or ordinary party secretaries, I mean village heads, okay? In China, there are more than 60,000 villages. All the village heads, party secretaries, were collected in the county level party school to listen to a centralized teaching system. Ask them to, for those who can read Chinese, you will see, basically train them to revitalize the countryside. 1 week, closed door, study, listen to the highest level lectures, and then model party secretaries giving live examples about how they did it, okay? And so I said, this is Weber Schramm at the Central Party School. He could only wish that this happened. I don't know if he is turning on his grave or not, but if you read Weber Schramm, I would argue that it's this Central Party, the Chinese Communist Party, that live up to his idea nowadays. He promotes communication technology for development, right? He has article books called Communication National Development, right? Now it was the, I believe it's the Chinese Communist Party. That's the best student of Schramm. So that's why my play on Weber Schramm at the Central Party School. So again, this is, for me, it's quite extraordinary. What I won't say a spectacle. All the body suffrages of the Chinese villages were gathered at certain body school, each level. See, you can tell how many classrooms, 3, 5, 6, 8 classrooms. And they were not, because I know some of the body suffrages, they told me that they were not allowed to have cell phones during the teaching sessions. They were supposed to really focus on what the central party was seeing. And they were mobilized to find their way to revitalize the countryside. What I heard one party secretary told me, from next year, each village was supposed to will have a collective rural income or operational income. If I give a donation, that's not good enough. They have to sell coffee or whatever. They have to have 20,000 in terms of village income from business operations. That's how you revitalize the countryside, or according to the party's plan, okay? So, okay, that's my introduction. I know already a lot of time has gone through, but it doesn't matter, that's the grand narrative. So village to global, global to village. Early on, what I present is a grand narrative of the from Marx to Xi. On today, today's May 4th, Xi wrote a letter. Oh, of course, some student wrote to him first. He wrote a letter to whom? Not Beijing University, not Tsinghua University. Can you guess which university? I already said that. What do you guess?
Agriculture.
Yes, Chinese Agriculture University students encourage them to have deep feelings and love for the countryside and learn skills to boost the countryside on May 4th. Okay, so that itself is again a strong message, right? Okay, so now about myself a bit. Bing Chun has already told you that I returned to the countryside. So I start to engage the Western world, the Shram inspired media narrative that so long as Chinese media go commercialized, may eventually, market will challenge state. Right, the market versus state dichotomy. I was engaging that earlier on, but later I realized, hey, that's a little bit too, I won't say too easy, but things are more complicated. So my second book, I began to look at China's revolutionary history and also look at the social terrain, struggles of workers, peasants, right? So I spent another 10 years for another book after my PhD. Then I spent yet another 10 years engaging with the rural. Early on was writing more theoretically, looking east, going south, working with Pulau Chong body, developing so-called transcultural political economic communication. But then I said, that's not good enough. So 10 years ago, I decided to return to the countryside to get my hands dirty, to truly engage in rural revitalization, okay? So I became an activist. Believe me, at the 19th Party Congress, when the party's program had rural revitalization as a national strategy, I was very happy. I said, hey, this is the kind of party I want. Mind you, I was never a party member, okay? I'm still not. So, but the point is, I had advocated for more emphasis on the rural. And I feel, you know, yes, I have some Liang Shuming on me. But now I think after I won't say China's industrialization process has come to an end, right? Right now, China is still, you know, engaging in intensive technological war with the US, right? On cutting edge technologies from AI to whatever, right? But now, at least in the countryside, after ruthless process of industrialization, the countryside is wired. The countryside is, you know, on every, I won't say every aspect, but highly modernized. Now I feel Liang Suni's dream of rural reconstruction can be pursued in a more meaningful way. So I want to say, you know, between the debate between Mao and Liang Shuning, who win, who lose, I think it's, you have to look at this as a long historical process. One step ahead, then, you know, another step back, that kind of thing. So I myself went back to the countryside, built this one person, I will say, basically a shadow institution called Heyang Institute for Rural Studies. And then began basically try to do some underground work. The reason was I was shocked when I went back to my own village and I saw my classroom look like this. Literally pumpkin were growing inside. And I was really heartbroken. And I said, no, that's not right. The process that the Communist Manifesto described as, you know, how many rural people were, you know, saved from idiocy of the countryside. Of course, I was one of those, but I really never thought of my own, the rural life I left behind as being anything but an idiot, right? So of course, you know, it has isolation, it has patriarchy, all that, but I feel it's worthwhile to do something. So I went back, and even today, you know, there are still villages like that. See, this was a picture. These pictures I just took this April, okay, during the Qingming Festival. And look at this on the right side. I will show you more clearly, okay? What's behind that slogan? Did you see that slogan? For those who can read in Chinese, 全世界无产者联合起来. That's the last line of the Communist Manifesto, right? It's an ancestor hall that used to be used as a school classroom. Most of us, people like me, got educated on the Mao in the ancestor hall. And you can see still relics there. That's a stage. Traditionally, you perform operas, local operas, right? Now this building was collapsing and this old man was a cousin of one of my friends who also came from this village, now he's a local official. And this is his poem. He sent to me, oh, not quite polished yet. That is the Shundu clan's ancestor hall of this family clan. At one point were full of, you know, students reading, right? And he said, I want to go home, but I'm afraid of going home, but I really want to go home. Go home meaning want to return to a village like this and try to rebuild it. And he's a local official who soon to retire. And as he was thinking of what going to do with his, the rest of his life, he was thinking of return to this village. And he said, you know, I'm going to collect all my family members, I'm going to build a cooperative, and I'm going to revitalize this village. And you may ask, what the hell? You have houses in Hangzhou, in the county, why do you feel attached to this place? And I would say that's culture. That's people like me of my generation. I just feel, no, I don't want that village become, you know, it's gone. And I think that is a strong feeling there, okay? No, this is the guy, this is my friend. He's a local official. And he said, well, he's still thinking, okay? Because it's a huge step. And what I did, so I built this Heyang Institute for Rural Studies. I turned, Bingsu, you visited me once, right? During one of the Heyang forms.
Yes.
I'm soon going to be, next year, I'm going to do the 10th anniversary. So here's the invitation. Please come. So I have a joke. I said, okay, rather than just writing one more theoretical pieces, I would rather go home, help my county party secretary selling more Chinese hometown pancakes. So this is a Zhejiang Daily, you know, the Zhejiang Provincial Party organ, a whole page story about me going home and doing research on local food industry, basically. Or you can call it the creative industry, because the food itself is being aestheticized, culturized, right? So I was involved in all kinds of things, field schools. Maybe I can come here solicit Bingchun, you can send your students to my hometown. And I would be more than happy to entertain them, to provide insight, to be your native informant. Mm-hmm. Okay, that's what I do. And then I do communication culture empowerment, making locals speak. I wrote, do research on oral histories. I wrote stories about local peasants. And then I became a rural development think tank, me and a friend, another retired classmate. Sometimes in my house, I have party secretary, local party secretary, village council leader just walk into my house, say, hey, do this. So I become fully organic, okay? Another thing, on June 1st, of course, in here, probably you won't be able to watch a film. I became part of the planner of a feature film, okay? It's called the Sendoudou Yunai Ba. Okay, because my local scene, the county where I come from, is very oriental, you know, just you imagine the local, you know, the southern Chinese countryside. So for that, during the 50s, my hometown become the southwest for the Shanghai film studios. Because Shanghai film studio, when they want to shoot stories about Yunnan, Huizhou is too far. So they use my county as Yunnan, Asima. Asima is a film about, you know, southwest. But the actual scenes where I shoot were in my hometown, Zhejiang, okay? And then during the reform era, my hometown become Jiangwu. A lot of, you know, the Kung Fu films, television shows were taken there, okay? Even Dao Si Xia San, Chen Gai Ge's famous, or not so famous. It didn't do very well, actually. It was also shoot there. That is your site, your scenery, your landscape become other people's stories, okay? That's what happens with the peripherals, right? If you are not, you only have scenes, but you don't have stories. You have nobody able to tell your own stories. That's your fate, right? But I went back there, I mobilized people, say, no, let's don't do that. Let's tell our own stories. So the first feature film, only, you know, 500,000 yuan, low investment, is going to be shown on Yuanxie, okay? On June 1st. That's me down there, okay? At the opening. Then another film, even Li Yugang, like a past, not so current film star, get attracted, not film star, just a cultural figure, got attracted by my home county local officials. They try all the means possible to impress him. Now he called him in his secondary home and he's shooting his film there. Okay? It's called Yun Shang De Yun. It's called the English story is love and nostalgia. Okay, and then what my county has been doing over the past, reinvent itself. Okay, this mountain top look very, what is it, male centric, huh? this mountain top, this, you know, this isolated power of stone tower, of course, it's just a physical feature, right? It's volcano mountain, basically. But the Chinese legend had it that, you know, one of China's ancestors, earlier legendary ancestors, the Yellow Huang Di, not Yellow Emperor. We refuse to call him Yellow Emperor because that connected with emperor, right? Feudal system. But we call him Huang Di. Supposedly went to heaven from the top of that mountain. Okay, so that's their invention. And then now it become a big deal. Every year, there are rituals or grand ceremonies in memory of this, celebrating the huge, the big Chinese family, basically, right? This is the local scene, very, you know, oriental, very southern China-ish, right? This is the grand ceremony. Every spring, Qingming, local officials all dress up formally, and then pay tribute to your ancestor, like your the ancestor of all ancestors, right? And they put out all really great ceremony, all remaining traditions. Now this ceremony is a national heritage. The Chinese government will register all kind of national heritage. It's reinvented by local people, but it took track, okay? And of course, actually one time I took some scholars to experience that, and my dear friend Lin Chun, when upon seeing my message, my picture, said, Yue Zhi, I'm really worried about you. This kind of ceremony are not compatible with Marxism. And I took her question very seriously. I had some source search. Was I pressured to do this? Not really. But being there, when I got invited to attend, I said, okay, sure. And when one time I organized a scholar summer school, I purposefully invite all the scholars to attend the ceremony. I don't know why I was doing that, but I just feel that you need to, as scholars, you need to engage with what's going on locally. So I was really grateful to Lin Chun, who asked me this hard question. Being a Marxist or being advocating or pursuing a Marxist line of academic research, and how do you reconcile that with, you know, basically, if you put it bluntly, ancestor worship ceremonies, right? And how do you reconcile that? And then I said, oh yeah, it's hard. But I found, you know, I said, okay, I can find inspirations in, here we're in the UK, right? A great British internationalist, David Crook, he said, while he was still alive, he said, you know, when I passed away, I like to have the following line on my gravestone: British Jewish communist, friends of the Chinese people, teacher. So from there, I believe you can have multiple identities. You can have Marxism as your political belief, but culturally, well, since I was born Chinese, I can't get away with that. Even I feel myself being an internationalist. When I was in Canada, people point me, say, hey, where are you from? I said, I'm Canadian. No, where are you originally from, right? And when I set up the double degree, I saw I was doing like the others, collaborating or doing international collaboration. But then I was accused of sleeping with the communists, right? Find my dear political economy friends, because I'm Chinese. So I realized maybe I can just take away my Chinese identity or share it. And if that's the case, might as well, if not embrace it, just engage with it. So that's what I was doing, okay? And then, yes, what do you eat, right? The taste of genie salpi. The double side, I have salpi actually. These are small ones, so I'm going to leave it here, pass here. So this is the small one, not the big one, okay? The double side of rurality and modernity, or what I'm eating, or what you're eating, right? So it was just a local pancake or something roasted, or like pizza, right? But during the process of the local government trying to solve the problem of poverty, they began to, this is how, you know, makeshift people will use this kind of, you know, this, there it was the oven, like the pizza oven, right? It's just different ways. And then you have some flour dough, and then some pork, and then some reserved vegetable, which I will show next. Okay. And then the local government set up a government office to make this a local brand. Soapy, bad. Okay. Literally, the government office for the promotion of, or the brandification of soapy. And they train masters, the party school, no, not the television university, which I mentioned earlier, began to provide free classes to train Saudi masters. So a government itself get involved in the promotion of a local industry, turn a rural specialty into a modern industry. And I was involved in this. And so last week, they made this a big deal, a national soybean festival. So all kind of soybean, you know, different in China, different ways of making this kind of local food. All those vendors got invited to the Jilin County. This is an official standing there formally, right? Against the background of a county building, which is the background is the county government building. In front is this huge square. It's the same as Zibo, basically, right? Government involved in promoting local industries. And see, this is the local soybean master people in the ring line up for 5 yuan a piece of the pancake. And there, you know, Hebei, somebody from Hebei, far away, another way of making soap, a local food, right? Came and then line up. I line up there for a long time and got my taste. So you can say it's crazy, but that's what's going on. So all kind of cultural festivals were being staged to promote the local economy. And you can see there, the slogan is work on the common prosperity road, right? So the political slogans, the local industry, but for most people just having fun over the night. Oh no, yeah, over a weekend, this is the May Day holiday season, right? China has 250 billion million people on the move, promoting local consumption, right? This is what it looked like. And yes, me, back in my home. Why this student is a Zhejiang University student from Zimbabwe. He came to visit me, and he's a culture ambassador of the local county. And why? Because he's doing his master's thesis. And he said, you know, visiting the northern part of Zhejiang, they are too advanced. The experience were not reproducible. But my home county's experience of promoting, you know, your local food is more reproducible. So he was already doing research on how the local government developed the soybean industry by making it a brand. Basically, you appropriate the Western idea of the brand. Like Stuart Ewen writing a brand, Naomi Klein, you know, continuing the Western brand. But what you do in China is they turn the Western notion brand, which you associate with, you know, Coca-Cola, Nike, all that, into a public brand. That is, the local government will administer a local brand, like Lishui, which is my home city. Local government has a state enterprise managing a localized public brand. So Western idea, you know, Western, you should say capitalistic notions of brand. In the West, you know, at certain moments you have, you know, progressives were attacking the brands, right? But in China, what they do is they domesticate it. The Western idea brand and it turned into a public brand. I will show you later more. So this guy was visiting, doing research on the soybean industry, how the government play a role, how the market play a role. And I said, hey, I already written 2 reports. Why don't you use it as reference? So I invited him to my home and I gave him my 2 soybean reports. So if you or been to haven't seen me writing a lot of peer reference papers, that's because I'm writing reports like that.
I think I have a copy of your first soybean report.
Yeah?
Yeah.
So again, I'm collaborating actually right now with an SMU student, a doctoral student of mine, on rurality and modernity. So I'm trying to theorizing from a case like this, the relationship between rurality and modernity, okay? I don't know how far I will go. So again, these are details, you don't need to look at it. It's how the government invent all this, you know, industrialization, cultural heritage. Well, you are from UK. You know how you develop your cultural industry, creative industry, right? You set up all kind of heritage regimes, all kind of cultural industry standards. And so this is what happened there. You know, just pancake making from a county level heritage, registered heritage, to finally established as a national cultural heritage. So this is a process where rurality met the state and then become codified a certain knowledge, certain procedure, industrial rural production procedures become modern standards, right? So you can see how this happened. And of course, it creates jobs, right? And now I'm going to show you a second product, product placement. This house looks beautiful, right? Very massive. It's a building that will showcase procedures for a reserve vegetable making, okay? This is the field, it grows. It's kind of almost like a mustard, a green, okay? This green, you make it reserve vegetable. Traditionally, my mother can make it, I can make it, but it's totally homemaking things. Just traditional society. In the winter, you don't have any more greens, or in the spring, you have too much of these greens. So you're fermented, you're turning into a dried vegetable. That's it, right? But now you're developing into an industry. So these women were now being employed by the local business. And now this is the machinized washing process. This is how it's dried. It's very clean, see, because it never even touched the ground. And this is a businessman. A year ago when I met him, he was not even doing this. He was totally in another industry. But now, over less than a year, he had invented himself this production line and turned the traditional homemaking procedures into industrialized processes. So you literally see the industrialization of Chinese agriculture. And this is the product. And it's here. He hasn't even sold it yet. The other day I just met him and he said, hey, do you want some of this? I said, sure, I will take it to my friends. So this is not market yet. But now what's important is what is here, okay? This is the culture side.
Sorry to interrupt, because we are approaching the end of the session. I know you haven't finished, but I already see someone raising hands. So I think there's some very keen audience already.
Right. So what I'm going to tell you is how you gain cultural confidence, okay? So I came from an area that is so isolated. My local dialect, if I speak my Chinese dialect, nobody can understand other than people from my hometown. So we call it 菜干,菜瓜,菜瓜, okay? But when originally the local meet the modern, we're so lack of self-confidence. We call this 梅干菜, which is where Shaoxing, you know, from northern part of China, they are more modernized, right? So we call this 梅干菜. But eventually, the county regained cultural confidence. Why? Because it turned out that through scientific procedures, they discovered that this type, the way we made it, has the lowest level of, what is the chemical name? Nitrate? It's something that's harmful to your body, okay? But, so in order to differentiate, they reinvent their own name. Now it's called the Caigan officially. See, that's why it's called Caigan. So for me, this is a metaphor of the gaining of your own cultural confidence through encounter with the modern. And I feel this is applicable to nations, different social groups. When you encounter the modern, you don't know who you are. Say, hey, there's already a name, so let's use it. But then eventually you realize, hey, we're better. We're more healthy. They have scientific proof because they measure the level of this chemical, right? And eventually the county now registers Caigan, no longer Meigancai. And I feel this process itself is a process you acquire your cultural self-confidence through encounter with modernity. At the beginning, you lost yourself. You don't know who you are. You borrow a name. And I feel this is something that can be scholarly interesting. Or I see this as the same transcultural process, the same as yellow tea. I'm not going to go further, okay? all kinds of festivals. And here, I just want to see one more thing. So it's a yellow tea festival. Yellow tea is a mutation of green tea, okay? But what I want to show is, look at, on the right side, the third line. Of all the sponsors or the organizers, there's something called 生态强村, 集体经济发展有限公司. That is, in order to boost the reorganize the peasantry and boost the local collective economy, the Chinese country, at least in my home area, they have revamped institutionally. They create basically a village or township level state enterprise or a collective economic unit called the 生态强村公司, strengthen the village company. And this, I won't say this is a return to the Mao era, but it's a process that I myself been fighting for as well. That is, if you want to stress the local economy, you've got to have farmers reorganize into collectives. And this is what they do. And so they were auction up here. You see the picture. This is an auction of yellow tea, okay? Here you are. One jin, 500 gram was auctioned for 60,000 liu wan. This business man, local business, bought it. But basically, it's a form of donation because the money goes to the collective. And here they create another brand. This is what I said, the common or local collectively owned local brand. So that farmers, when they grow their green tea or yellow tea actually, they will get the benefit of a collective brand because otherwise you won't sell your product at a high price, right? But the local brand was being managed by the local businessmen. So what you do is basically a private-public partnership in which Western Notions brand or has been domesticated, if you feel, synthesized or in the process of Chinese socialism, I guess. And you can see here, did you see the difference between the two groups? One, those are real farmers, black and teeth. This is for performance. You can see this wear, you know, costumes that's pleasing the camera. Those are real women. I would say these are not real women, okay? So everything is being culturalized. So see, 共富茶, common prosperity tea. And so what I want, and here you can see, these are all, you know, media people. Festival being put up to promote. So cultural, a lot of digital cultural element going into the whole process of revitalizing the countryside. So I'm going to conclude, okay? I don't know, but I do, you know, being on the ground, I feel may indeed blaze a development, China may develop a blaze a development path that transcends the freedom of traditional dependency. That is, you know, what I described earlier as, you know, in the Communist Manifesto. Of course, there are a lot of problems, corruptions. Believe me, like the hometown I grew up, have already had two consecutive party sectors who are on corrupt charges get arrested. Now, you know, there was a third one I got to know, okay? So these are real problems. Money got, you know, state money got, you know, not being used for projects, but, you know, sidetracked by local businessmen, all that kind of thing. But overall, I want to show you what's going on, or at least what I see as some of the real processes of rural revitalization, and in which communication and culture play a huge role. And again, coming back to the communication, earlier I had a Roger, Weber Schramm. Now, it's Everett Rogers. After he studied in the 70s, okay, what happened under Mao, he came up with the idea that yes, maybe each country should have its own road of development. And by definition, nowadays, each village actually is finding its own way. Okay, again, There are all kinds of experiments going on, different places. One place that's from Shandong, where a local party secretary, no, party organizational department had at that point. She was involved in organizing a lot of villages on a track of collective economy. And then she came up with a slogan, I feel, or equation, which I found interesting. The CPC's organization is more powerful than the organization private capital. And private capital, of course, the organized private capital, of course, more powerful than peasants. And of course, then this will leave you the impression that, okay, the party is all powerful, right? But in China right now, that is what's going on, right? And if you kind of have a central organizational department of the CPC surmount all the village leaders to attend class over a week without, you know, attending your cell phone, and they say, go back next year, produce your local economy, and this is the amount, and if you don't do it, next time you're not going to be appointed or elected. That's pretty serious, right? And in this process, I feel culture plays a huge role, because all this, for example, all this brand stuff is really reinvention of the stories. This, of course, is still the same product, but it's the cultural endowment, it's the branding, and it's the public branding that I found most interesting. And in this process, I do feel for myself, I have tremendous pressure in, of course, also tremendous challenge. You always have to walk on a fine line. For example, when I try to empower local agrarian activists to speak out, that's very dangerous, very serious. So you have to walk on a fine line, try to push for what you believe, but at the same time, mindful of the contradictions and also resistance, okay? But I do have feel that scholars have a whole world to gain in practice. And in that, I feel I'm living up to political economy. Or Marx's line, you know, the role of the scholar is not just to understand the world, but to change it for the better. Who knows? Okay, I stop here.
Thank you so much. I know we were supposed to end 5 minutes ago. That's fine. I have at least five comments slash questions, but I know we will have more time to talk afterwards. So I want to maybe first leave the opportunity to ask questions to those audience online, because I think before Professor Zhao finished, I already saw someone raising hand. Mm-hmm. So is there anyone online that wanted to ask the first question?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so you can exit and then see what is the question. Is there already a question?
Can they speak?
Yeah, I haven't really planned for online questions. So see if we can do the room first.
Okay.
Yeah.
Sorry
about get too excited.
I know your style. When I saw the number of your slides, I knew you were not gonna finish within an hour, but that's fine.
I didn't time it so properly.
No, there are actually no online questions. They are able to do the Q&A.
Okay.
Yeah.
Anyone? Yeah. So the first one here and then second one over there. Yes, go ahead.
Yeah. Hello, Professor Zhao. I'm Zi Chenghu. I'm the first year PhD student in media communication department at LSE. I have some comments instead of questions. I used to work in Zhejiang Daily in international communication department. Mm-hmm. And we were trying to run the Facebook and Twitter, those international media accounts, to try to tell the story about Zhejiang's rural revitalization to the wider audience. However, we encountered many, many dilemmas. First is that because it is a party affiliated media, which is marked by Twitter, so that created a lot of dilemma. We could not really reach out to the audience in the US, in the UK, and we got some very, very negative comments, like "you're a propagandist machine," this kind of comments.
Yeah.
And we did not really know how to tackle with that. Should we just leave it or delete it? If we delete it, they will follow up. Why do you delete that? And the second dilemma is that while we were talking about the topic we want to work on, I used to suggest to the editor that we may follow up the trendy topics like the feminist feminism or environmentalism to try to tell the wider the international audience that we are actually looking at this and we are doing very good. But mm-hmm. the editor told us that this is a very Western ideologically laden topic, and we should try to minimize the emphasis on the words like feminism or environmentalism in order to not to fall trap to the other discourses, which they have already assumptions about that. And that made me feel quite frustrated because I thought it might be interesting to engage with that kind of discourse with some perspective and experiences from China. Mm-hmm. But it didn't work out because I was just a very junior journalist.
Uh-huh. So you are caught in between.
Yeah.
Like a hard rock and an iron fist, because in both ways, it didn't. You feel there's no way to work out, right?
Yeah.
Because anything like say the stuff that I'm saying sounds very like what I already said today. You know, it's being transplaced. I said, okay, if I sounds like a rocket boost, so be it. I hope you won't get into trouble for getting a boost of local economy from China to speak. But again, the issue, even, okay, let's put it on another way. The question of rural revitalization really won't resonate with Western scholarship. Because believe me, when I went back to China, to my hometown, I told one of my Western friends, I said, hey, this is what I'm doing. And then the scholar, or well, the Western scholar said, hey, you know, Eric Hobsbawm already said that the big, you know, one of the big story of the 20th century is the end of a peasantry. Why would you still want to engage with it, right? So it's a non-issue for the Western scholarship. For North American, well, you erased the Aboriginal nations. Those are peasants. Those are, you know, people of southern villages. And so you don't have a rural problem, only that you have Black problem. You have migrant, you know, labor from Mexican who come to California to pick up your fruits. Are those agricultural problems, right? And then you have Brazil. Lula was crying because some people were hungry. Why? Brazil has such a fertile land, only that those land were controlled by US multinationals. Instead of produce food to feed people, you produce sugar canes that produce gasoline, right? Or coins. So as if the world has no agrarian problem. And so for people like me to speak about rural revitalization in Zhejiang sounds very parochial. The only thing is I don't mind because I'm a retired professor, so what? Right? I don't need tenure. And if Tsinghua University say, hey, Zhao, that's not we hire you for. I said, okay, good. I can quit and go back to my countryside, right? So on the one hand, your way of promoting the message, you're trying to use the story of rural China to project an image of China to the West won't work. On the other hand, your effort of, like what you're saying, the second part of your story, right? Feminism. And if you speak like the language of feminism, right now the Chinese, certain official line will say this sounds very Western. And it is indeed true that Chinese women, the story of women's liberation in China has a different past than the Western 1, 2, 3 waves of feminism. Bing Chun knows more than that. So the moment you begin to speak the language of feminism, some people were worried because we say 妇女性别平等，妇女解放. We say 妇女, women. But here you say 女性, and those are different things. Like what I say, 菜干，梅干菜, right? 菜瓜. So that itself has implications for your identity and your politics, right? To speak 女性 or 妇女, or you call yourself a 妇女? No, you call yourself a 女性. But the moment you call yourself a 女性, not a 妇女, you're already in the Western discourse. So that's why, you know, some of those, you know, as you say, your officials or the more powerful ones might not like you try to make Chinese stories of women's liberation into the Western discourse. So that you'll end up being not being able to communicate. But still, I feel it's important to try at least. That's why I come here this time, after 3 years of self-imposed isolation. Even though this time—
You haven't given up your hope on us.
No, I haven't. First, I sincerely believe that, you know, people should be here doing work, but I feel, you know, for the rest of my life, because every people's life is short. I've already written my books, but when even my dearest friend realized that your book was nothing, you're a Chinese, you're a communist, even though I wasn't, then I said, okay, for the rest of my life, I would rather go back and try to sell a little bit more of the pancake, enrich a little bit more of my neighbors, not neighbors, you know, the local people, then try to write one more SSCI paper that only have 3 people read, right? So it is a personal choice. And I'm glad at my age, I had my luxury of choice. Most people don't. So I sympathize with your dilemma, but I hope you will find another way to try. And when it doesn't work, come to me, work for my rural institute. I can feed you, okay? And then when you realize that, you have nothing to lose, only your freedom to gain. Okay, sorry.
Okay, yeah. Well, I know we have another question online, but okay. Just before we, okay, you can read it. Chen Hao is a student of mine, and he's also from Zhejiang, actually. He's from Wenzhou. So,
okay, yeah, this is a very good question. That is, you know, issue related to structural issues with rural development. On the one hand, I do believe that overall, the basic structure for rural revitalization positively is still there. Officially, for example, rural land is supposed to be still collectively owned, but the local budget, especially county level budget, was so poor, so bad that local government depend on real estate. You won't believe, like my home county, like in a mountains area, has a real estate market. The price of a house is even more expensive than some big cities. Okay, so local government were very highly dependent on real estate, selling of land for its sustenance. That's one problem. Another, collective ownership of land in name only, de facto privatization of land in reality. So for example, the heritage where I grow up still has about 80 households that do not have a plot of land to build houses. Why? Not because this county government won't allow the village to have land use rights for house building, but because some local farmers, they had, if for that to happen, for the houses to be built, they have to be willingly give up their plot of land for others to use. But now because the contract land had already been de facto privatized, you can, you know, force that household to give up their land. Therefore, those land will never be available for other families to build houses. So de facto privatization of farmland, on the one hand, it looks like good, protecting the rights of certain farmers. But since these farmers, they already have their own new houses, but other people don't in the village. But if this farmer decide not to give up willingly his contract land, then the other family won't be able to build the house on that contract land. So the problem then becomes much more complicated than what you think. So it's a constant struggle, to be sure. And again, the state and the private and the industrial capital are pouring tons of money into the countryside, including surplus cultural capital, like professors' time, like designers, because after all those architects, designers, all the cultural industry workers, you know, high level artists, all those people, now they find urban life boring. So they are willing to go to the countryside. A lot of people want to go to the countryside to open up B&B, like Minshu, right? And there are constant stories of conflict between urban born, well, people from the urban areas are willing to go into the countryside to revitalize, but they have certain priorities. And the local peasants, if they were not mobilized or if they didn't see their own interest, they're not going to support that. So there are tremendous conflicts. But I feel conflicts are, I mean, unavoidable. The challenge is how you move ahead or try to resolve those conflict in the best interest of the local farmers, especially the poor and the weaker group. But right now, I feel in the countryside, there are still a lot of potentials for work out certain things. And you have to do it. Push forward rather than wait for a perfect moment. Or you just say, hey, let's have the policies in place. Because policy is one thing, the actual implementation is another thing. So you have no choice but to get your hands dirty and try to find out what you can do, what is possible. Okay, any other questions? Yeah. Yes, there.
First, thank you, Professor Zhou, for giving us this speech. So I have two questions. The first is, do you mind clarify it again, the difference between Chongzhenhua and urbanization? And second, my main question is, when I was listening to the speech, I was wondering, like, the strategies you've mentioned, like promoting local food, making films, and organizing some festivals. But I'll say that from my own experience, at least for now, the current trend is that the countryside is still not that attractive to young people, especially for women.
Mm-hmm.
And part of the reason is like the social norm in the rural area is quite unfriendly to women. So women are still thinking about going to large cities where they are more like a multiculturalism.
Uh-huh.
So I'm thinking that if in long term, young people are not willing to stay in countryside or go back to the countryside,
mm-hmm.
In long term, there's not enough population in the countryside. So
mm-hmm.
how can you say that your strategies can be sustainable in terms of the rural revitalization?
Mm-hmm. Good question. The first one, sorry, what is the first one I forgot?
Oh yeah, Chongzhenhua.
Chongzhenhua, yes. Okay, urbanization is what we see here, right? Basically, the growth of urban areas, the people from rural areas, small towns, move to the cities. In China, I think, I like what I said, since earlier reform, it has always been that. So the movement of people from rural areas, including township and a county level, even municipal levels, like we call it 三线四线城市, right? Move to big cities so that you have Beisangguang, and also the provincial capitals as the urban centers. But by 2013, there was a major conference, national conference, in which Xi chaired that conference and officially, I think, made a transition from what's unspokenly an urbanization policy to what, like what I showed you earlier, 城镇化. 城镇化 means development of small towns and county level economies. So the difference is a question of scale, really. But also I think overall infrastructural development that's directly more at township level and county level and smaller cities And I think there was a track of this movement, at least from policy level. But again, this relates to your second question. That is how fast you can rebalance and what kind of measure you use to encourage people to move to small towns. Early on, a few years ago in Beijing, there's that the cleansing of so-called what? 低端人口, right? That's very draconian. And there was a lot of protest. But I think nowadays, there has been more effort. Even like what I said earlier, Xi Jinping, you know, at least May 4th, of course, it's a symbolic gesture that write a letter to the agriculture university students, say, hey, go to the countryside. But there are indeed quite a lot of incentives. And it's not, and I'm not sure the extent to which gender is an issue, to be honest. Maybe I came from an area that is historically gender repression wasn't so serious. Because there are tremendous difference between North China, where Confucian's values were more resilient, as opposed to like Southern China. In my hometown, oh, I can boast. You know who found my county? Wu Zhetian. If you're a feminist, you got to study why Wu Zhetian would, over 1300 years ago, found a county like this. So Taoist culture has been quite strong in my area. And I think Taoist, even if you talk about traditional Chinese culture, I think you need to make a distinction between, you know, Confucius culture and the Taoist or Buddhist. Certain of these values were, or certain of this kind of thinkings or philosophies were a little bit more supportive of women. So my feeling is nowadays, I don't think the reason for youth not going to the countryside is as strongly related to gender repression as just overall socioeconomic issues. Male, female are equally not inclined, if you have a choice, to go to stay in the countryside. Even though, as I say, nowadays, there are all kinds of incentives. And in the end, the problem is not your choice. It's just simply that you won't be able to survive at Beijing, right? I mean, survive doesn't mean you're not going to stop, but real estate price is so high. Job market is so tight in Beijing. Even if you got PhDs, you won't be able to find a job in Beijing or big cities. So it will be the dual compulsion of the economy that drive people back to the small towns. Therefore, facilitate the process of 城镇化 rather than 城市化. I.e., it's a question of choice, but also it's a question of you have no choice but to go back to the countryside. And I will speak my experience, purely from my own experience from this Lulun Institute. When I set up this 10 years ago, it will be absolutely unimaginable that today, my institute for the first time hire a full-time job program coordinator. And guess who she is? She was born in my same village and she got an MA from Leeds here in communication. And she is willingly saying that I want to stay in my hometown. I support NGO type of work. And for me, that's totally unimaginable 10 years ago. And that for me is progress. And again, I don't have data or statistics, but this person that suddenly arrived.
You know, we have a media communication development program in the department.
Uh-huh.
So I should really talk to my colleague who is directing that program.
Okay.
And more students to you. We have one more question line, and I think given the time, that's going to be our final question.
I'm studying labor, so more concerned with the way the exciting cultural creative enterprise of China is organized. You mentioned that the peasant workers are fairly treated.
I'm really curious about the mechanisms that have been put in place at the corporate level, making sure that it fits. Is there any work to bring together process of production, consumption? What kind of do you think has made this sustainable? When ultimately people have to compete in the market, what do you find it has to be the compromise? Okay.
Labor conditions.
Labor conditions. Again, I'm doing quite a lot of research. Last time I did a piece with Zhang Zihua on digital labor in the countryside. It's very interesting because if you import simply Western or political economy based digital labor, everybody's writing about that. But in the countryside, if you go and do some investigation, a lot of these were what we called digital petty bourgeois. That is small town independent producers. Some of those people were not working in the digital factory like what you imagine. Some of those were individual shops, you know, different kind of small shops where they themselves were in charge, has more autonomy. That's one thing. Another kind, labor regime, in the production line, for example, Meigancai. Some of these women were not organized early on. They were just housewives. They don't have any cash income. But now in the factory, at least they have cash income. And how bad they're treated or how well they're treated, it's hard, at least for me, I haven't looked into this particular factory because it was set up just in front of my eyes in the past few months. So I don't know whether these women are going to organize in terms of, you know, trade unions that. I don't think so. Because what happened is the shop is in the village. And these women were working in the local village. Therefore, there's a strong, what I would call, like, let me cite Polony. Like, these are local.
Socially embedded.
Exactly. These are socially embedded. Productions. It's not like your migrant labor going to Shenzhen. So there are local moms there that's going to play a role. And also the local government is watching over the shoulders of the entrepreneur. So I have here you have state market and the local community that's mutually negotiating the labor regime, if you will. So anything like the Vince Mosco type of digital labor, you know, digital workers world united, well, when you try to ground in the local economy, it's much more complicated. And so I'm glad you are sensitive to the labor issue because that's almost, we have almost like an automatic thinking, right? Labor rights, yes, very important. But if you go really, to the ground, several ways, like what I said, one is you are locally embedded, and now there's a lot of these, we call 数字小生产者, digital petty producers in the local context. And also another thing is, when you're working in the local factories, you have a lot of labor, local support, like your family, and you don't commute so far. Last time I did an interview of a local shop, like a digital shop, and the workers were actually pretty, I won't say happy, but they were pleased. And those are young people. So what I'm thinking is, the question is very important, but it's tremendously important to go and investigate. And for that, I'm going to end with a note. That is, this summer, my Global to Village summer school is going to be in Ningxia, and it's about digitalization in the countryside, and we have a strong emphasis on labor. So I welcome people to come and to look at for yourself, okay?
All right, great. I think we really need to end there. Thank you so much.
Thank you. Oh, yes, so these are for you.